Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Babbel, speak a new language with confidence. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian and German. Babbel is designed to quickly get you speaking your new language within weeks, and their convenient lessons are only 10 to 15 minutes each. Lessons are lovingly created by over 100 language experts, not by a translation machine. Babbel is available as an app or online, and your progress will be synced across all devices. Here are the easy steps to speak a new language with confidence. Download the app or go to babbel.com. Select the language of your choice and try it for free. That's Babbel, BABBEL.com. Babbel, speak a new language with confidence.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 15th of September, these are our main stories. Two major oil facilities are attacked with drones in Saudi Arabia, with Houthi rebels in Yemen claiming responsibility. What could this latest development mean for the long and bloody conflict? Praise for Robert Mugabe at his funeral in Zimbabwe.
As a result of his unflinching stance, the land has now been reunited with the people.
But many appeared to snub the event, with only a sparse crowd at the stadium. And why has the Trump administration said it will ban flavoured electronic cigarettes? Also in this podcast, after the devastation wrought by Hurricane Dorian, the Bahamas brace for more storms.
We are very concerned that the path and the intensity of Dorian could possibly be replicated. And we are keeping a very close eye on all of the systems in the Atlantic.
And?
Videsh ki ek bhasha, jiske karan videshi bhashaon ko jagah na mile. Aur desh ki ek bhasha ho.
How this speech has stirred up a row about language in India. And we start with those attacks on the oil facilities in Saudi Arabia. A wave of drone assaults targeted an oil field operated by Saudi Aramco, sparking a huge fire. It was carried out by the Houthis, the rebel group the Saudis have been fighting in Yemen since civil war broke out there 4 years ago. The raids could impair oil production in Saudi Arabia, as well as embarrassing the authorities. Our correspondent Paul Adams reports.
These were audacious attacks on the heart of Saudi Arabia's vital oil industry. The processing plant at Abqaiq is one of the world's largest, pumping millions of barrels of oil to terminals on Saudi Arabia's east and west coasts. Khurais, to the southwest, is home to the kingdom's second largest oil field. The plants were hit before dawn. Huge explosions lit up the night sky and thick smoke billowed from both. Later, the Saudi authorities said the fires were under control. It's not known how much damage was done or how badly production was affected. Yemen's Houthi rebels are jubilant. A spokesman said it was one of the biggest operations their forces had carried out inside Saudi Arabia. He said it involved 10 drones and came after what he called precise intelligence work and prior reconnaissance in cooperation with honourable people inside Saudi Arabia. None of this can be verified, but there's no doubt this is a huge embarrassment for the Saudi authorities. This was a complex, coordinated attack conducted from hundreds of miles away, apparently using long-range drones, almost certainly supplied by the Houthis' Iranian backers. Saudi Arabia has had plenty of practice at shooting down Houthi ballistic missiles, but seems to have less success against drones. And it appears to be part of a general escalation by the Houthis, coming on the back of a number of recent drone and missile attacks on Saudi oil installations, airports and other facilities. Later, the Saudi-led coalition launched several airstrikes on Houthi targets in northern Yemen. It's not clear if these represented retaliation or merely a continuation of the Saudi-led campaign that's now gone on for 4.5 years.
The attack has raised concerns that it may affect global oil supplies. The Saudi oil company Aramco has described the Abqaiq facility as the largest crude oil processing plant in the world. It's estimated it can process up to 7 million barrels a day. Our business correspondent Kate Prescott told me what this could mean for the global oil market.
The latest that we're hearing is that half of Saudi Arabia's oil production could have been knocked offline by this. But that's 5% of the global oil supply. Markets are currently closed for the weekend, but come Monday, I do expect that there'll be, if that's true, a significant spike in the oil price as a result of this.
So it could have possibly long-term effect for consumers.
It's very difficult to say because what happens on the markets is a little bit separated from what we see at the petrol pump, and it actually takes about a month or so to feed through. And so we do really need to wait to hear what Aramco has to say about exactly what the disruption is. I think one of the really interesting things, though, about this is what it could do and what it says about risks to oil production in the region as a whole. It only takes one lucky strike like this to show just how vulnerable Saudi Arabia's oil production facilities are. And it comes at quite a difficult time for the country as they look to float a chunk of Saudi Aramco on the stock exchange. It's a time when they want to show it at its very best. And actually what this has done is really show just how vulnerable it is.
That was Kate Prescott. One of Africa's great liberation leaders was remembered on Saturday, as was one of its most brutal dictators. Robert Mugabe was both these things and more. For 37 years, he led Zimbabwe through good times and into economic ruin, having fought for its liberation for many a long year before taking power. He died 8 days ago. Our Africa correspondent Andrew Harding reports from the state funeral in the capital, Harare.
It's a warm, bright day in Harare's National Sports Stadium. Dozens of African leaders, past and present, veterans of the continent's liberation struggles have been arriving over the past hour or so. Robert Mugabe's funeral service is about to get underway, but I think it's significant and telling that this stadium, which seats about 60,000 people, is by no means full. I'd say at most there were 6,000 or 7,000 people here, which tells you something. Robert Mugabe's coffin is now being brought in front of me here, soldiers accompanying the coffin. Behind that, members of Mr. Mugabe's family, and then Emmerson Mnangagwa, the man, of course, who was for years, for decades, Robert Mugabe's closest ally, but then became the man who pushed him out of power and took over from him 2 years ago.
Send condolences to the Mugabe family.
So now it's President Mnangagwa's turn to praise his former ally and his achievements. No mention of his errors.
A giant tree of Africa has fallen. Indeed, the bold, steadfast, and resolute revolutionary comrade Robert Gabriel Mugabe is no more.
Now here's South Africa's leader Cyril Ramaphosa, and remarkably, he's being booed. That's a reaction by the crowd to the recent xenophobic attacks on African immigrants in South Africa.
What has happened in South Africa goes against the principles of the unity.
It's an interesting moment. This is a ceremony steeped in the ideas of Pan-Africanism, of African unity. But I wonder how much that really still resonates here.
We as Africans, we say we are united because we are united.
But there's a lot of talk of African unity, but in practice, there are still very difficult borders to cross. It's still very difficult to get visas.
It affects us.
We are not united as Africans. Like today, it's supposed to be, we're supposed to come together as Africans. But you could tell, you saw how the stadium was. My fellow people are in South Africa. They're being burnt in South Africa.
Xenophobic attacks.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you think this is just talk from the leaders, but not real?
Yes, exactly. I would say that from my point of view.
National salute!
A 21-gun salute signalling the end of this ceremony. Robert Mugabe's casket is being prepared now to be taken out of this stadium. He was due to be buried tomorrow at Heroes Acre, but a dispute with his family means that's now going to be delayed, perhaps for weeks, as the authorities build a special mausoleum for him. As he's taken out of the stadium now, Zimbabweans are left to reflect on all that Robert Mugabe achieved for Zimbabwe, all that he achieved for this continent, and of course, all that he got so terribly wrong.
That was Andrew Harding. Italy has assigned a safe port to a rescue ship with 82 migrants aboard 6 days after the first of them were rescued. Here's the moment the news was announced on the Ocean Viking.
We've just heard that we've been assigned a place of safety. We are now on our way to the island of Lampedusa in Italy.
Well, Sophie Bow is the co-founder of SOS Mediterranean, the humanitarian group which runs the ship. I asked for her reaction to the news.
We are extremely relieved with the news to be able to disembark in Lampedusa port. But I think it's a first step. Rescue is finished when people are put in safety, and it's not yet the case.
And what are conditions like on the boat at the moment?
Conditions are okay. They are stable. These 82 survivors can be protected from the elements. But these people are really tired. They have endured very difficult conditions of detention in Libya for most of them. Torture, sexual abuse, rape, slavery in some cases. And they are really fragile when they arrive. And on top of that, of course, they have had to cross the sea on these boats in distress, physically and psychologically very, very vulnerable people.
And do you have children on board at the moment?
Absolutely. We have 17 minors and one baby. There is a pregnant woman. Another one has been medevaced to Malta. Very luckily, she got the baby the next day and they are fine, both of them. The conditions are very precarious on a ship and nobody should stay long.
And European governments have said that they will take these people. Are you confident that they will honour that?
I think so. What we have learned from this 14 months without having Italy anymore opening their ports, every time there were some rescued people on board a rescue ship, they were spread amongst different states in Europe. So I hope that this first mechanism of coordination is at the moment effective. And we also hope that this will lead to a more predictable, coordinated and sustainable mechanism that would guarantee that we can every time disembark the rescued people in a safe port.
Next, President Trump has announced that his administration will ban flavoured electronic cigarettes after a surge of vaping-related deaths across the country. What initially appeared to be a few scattered hospitalisations this summer has now become a fully-fledged health scare. The US Centre for Disease Control and Prevention says the number of illnesses has more than doubled to over 400, including 6 deaths. But vaping has already become very popular, especially among young people. The BBC's Hayley Thomas reports.
The symptoms were basically like the stomach flu. I was throwing up nonstop, and it was tough to breathe. I never thought that it would do this to my lungs, and if I did, I wouldn't have started it.
After being addicted to vaping for nearly 2 years, 18-year-old Adam Hergenreeder was hospitalized, unable to breathe without the help of machines.
I was extremely scared for him, you know, worried about my son. Is he going to be okay? Is he going to have to be on oxygen for the rest of his life?
Doctors told him and his mother, Polly, the images of his lungs looked like those of a 70-year-old.
This was the CAT scan of Adam, and this shows all of the lung damage.
Now at home, Adam is able to breathe on his own, but his lungs will never be the same. And doctors say vaping is to blame.
I would say the saddest thing is that you look at Adam, and sure, he looks healthy, but come and ask him if he can go play a game of basketball, and he can't.
Cases like Adam's should be rare, but increasingly they're not. Across the United States, officials now say that vaping has likely caused people to suffer from lung disease, collapsed lungs, and even put some into a coma.
You want to know why I've decided not to smoke?
After decades of anti-tobacco campaigns, the number of teenage cigarette smokers has fallen sharply.
I don't need to smoke to prove myself.
But now, thanks to technology, a whole new generation is becoming addicted to nicotine in a different way.
Because it's vapor, not tobacco smoke.
Here in the U.S., there are hundreds of vaping brands for consumers to choose from, the most popular being the Juul Pen. Children can smoke these in schools without getting caught, but what really keeps them wanting more is the amount of nicotine it delivers in each hit.
With Juuls, things really changed with vaping. We started recognizing about a year ago that kids who are using vapes are getting a higher dose of nicotine.
Dr. Sharon Levy specializes in adolescent substance use and addiction at Boston Children's Hospital.
A lot of kids who come into our clinic are complaining of signs that we think about as nicotine toxicity, things like stomach aches and headaches and vomiting. And also, they describe a buzz that's really quite different than what you see with combustible cigarettes.
Juul Labs controls nearly 70% of the e-cigarette market. Kevin Burns is the CEO.
We think we have a product that is legal today and does not present a risk to the American public.
But state lawmakers say their investigations show Juul Labs went to great lengths to reach youth in schools and on social media. Last year, the company made efforts to rebrand itself after public outrage erupted over a surge in teen vaping.
I don't think our campaign was ever targeted to kids. We don't need to target youth to grow our business to be successful and fulfill our mission.
But many parents, doctors, and officials are doubting that claim.
That was Haley Thomas. Still to come.
I feel 100% European. And it was really, if this is what Britain wants, then I'm not British anymore.
How with Brexit on the horizon, some Brits are going Dutch. And a solid gold toilet is stolen from a stately home. So can police get to the bottom of it? Already devastated by Hurricane Dorian, the islands of the Bahamas are now bracing for the arrival of another storm. About 1,300 people are still missing and at least 15,000 are in need of shelter, food and medical care. And now more days of heavy rain and strong winds are predicted as Tropical Storm Humberto gathers strength. Dwayne Sands is the health minister for the Bahamas and has been talking to Julian Marshall about his concerns about what might happen in the days ahead.
We anticipate that certainly this weekend that there will be a deluge of rain as much as 5 inches and winds as much as 40 to 50 miles per hour. Now, we are grateful that that is the maximum likely intensity of this storm. Our real concern, quite frankly, is for the weather system that is following in its wake. And we are very concerned that the path and the intensity of Dorian could possibly be replicated. And we are keeping a very close eye on all of the systems in the Atlantic.
I mean, Minister, this would be absolutely disastrous in itself, but even more so for an island chain that has already been devastated by Hurricane Dorian and the relief efforts that are currently going on.
You know, we have 2.5 more months to go in the hurricane season that ends November 30th. No one that's living has ever seen anything like this in the Bahamas. We are deeply concerned given the fact that 80% of our landmass is less than 10 meters above sea level. And so with winds of 185 to 200 miles an hour, rain that is torrential, and a sea surge of as much as 25 feet, you have what can only be described as the perfect storm of climate change.
In the immediate future, are you trying to evacuate islanders from the path of the storm or to feed them and to help them where they are?
This particular storm, we are not going to be evacuating additional persons. However, if there is evidence that another storm of the intensity of Dorian, then certainly we would have to make plans accordingly, as even those people who have remained on Grand Bahama and remained in Abaco find that they have either homes or premises that have been damaged, or that they have no homes at all. And you have to juxtapose this to the fact that our shelters in New Providence are full. They are literally filled to capacity. So it is not just a theoretical discussion. We have some very serious decisions to make in the event that another category 2, 3, 4, or 5 storm were to approach our island chain.
That's the Bahamas Health Minister, Dwayne Sands. Since the UK voted to leave the European Union in 2016, there's been a rise in the number of British nationals choosing to become citizens of another EU country, including the Netherlands. More than 1,300 people gave up their British passports in exchange for a Dutch one last year, according to figures from the Dutch Immigration Service. Before 2016, barely anyone made the switch. Anna Holligan has been to meet two British families living in the Netherlands.
The Watts family are flipping pancakes. Anna Watts is an astrophysicist, originally from Leeds. She's just secured her Dutch citizenship.
It's just a huge relief to be done with all the mess, to know that no matter what happens, you know, in Westminster, it doesn't affect us. But no, not really a sense of disloyalty.
Right, what are you having on pancakes?
Do you like a pumpkin? Yeah. Quite hot. You might need to wait to cool.
Right, so I have a Dutch passport and only a Dutch passport. When I relinquished my British citizenship, I had to send my passport off and it doesn't come back. The girls have two. They have Dutch passports and a British passport as well. Because they're under 18, they're not able to relinquish their British citizenship, and so the Dutch government doesn't ask it. And Jason still has a British passport.
Yay! Gimme!
It felt a little weirder than I thought it would to hit the button to say, yes, I want to relinquish my citizenship. I didn't think it would affect me at all, because I was so fed up with the whole thing.
So what made Anna decide to sacrifice her British nationality?
It was in part just an emotional response to the referendum that I feel 100% European. And it was really, if this is what Britain wants, then I'm not British anymore, because I've lived all over in Europe, I worked all over in Europe, and this is where I belong. And also partly it was a practical thing. You know, this is where our jobs are, you know, our children were born here, this is where they've lived all their lives, and I wanted to protect their rights and my rights to be here as well.
Emotionally, I think we've had some great times together. I think I might shed a tear.
Jack Lavelle is traipsing through a park near his office at an Anglo-Dutch oil firm, still clutching his British passport, reluctant to let go.
So for me, changing my passport is a last resort. On the one hand, a passport is just a document which entitles you to live and work and travel in certain places. But on the other hand, there's a big emotional connection. Giving up my passport and my British citizenship is a significant sacrifice. My family has been British for as long as we've been able to trace back. I'm very proud Brit.
What do you think your Dutch passport will buy you that your British one won't in a year or so's time?
My home and my friends are here now, and I have a great job, and I don't want to be in a position where my employer can say, okay, thank you for your service, and now please get out of the country. I am feeling quite anxious. You don't want to emotionally do this. If things get too difficult, then that's the choice, really.
That report by Anna Holligan. Language is a sensitive political issue in many countries, and in India, the Home Minister, Amit Shah, has sparked a major row on social media about the place of Hindi in the country.
विदेशी भाषाओं को जगह न मिले और देश की एक भाषा हो इसी दृष्टि को ध्यान में रखते हुए.
So what did he say that has upset so many Indians? Ambarasan Etarajan is our South Asia editor.
He was basically saying it was very important to have a language of the whole country, which would become the identity of India. And he was referring to Hindi. And he also said if one language can do the work of uniting the country, then it is the most spoken language, Hindi. Now, this has triggered a lot of condemnation from non-Hindi speaking states, particularly from the south, which do not teach Hindi in many schools, particularly, for example, in the state of Tamil Nadu. Now, why this is a sensitive issue? Because, you know, India is a country of 1.3 billion people. When India got independence from Britain, you know, it is a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multilinguistic country. So a lot of people thought like the Indian federal structure would protect their cultural and linguistic identity. In the 1960s, there were, you know, riots in the southern state of Tamil Nadu because at that time the government wanted to say, you know, Hindi will be the official language and people should learn, must learn Hindi. Then a lot of people were killed. More than 10 people were killed in the clashes between security forces and the local people. So that is why the language issue is very, very important. And people say we are not against Hindi, but we are against imposition of Hindi.
Now, are people seeing these comments as part of a push, really, to impose Hindi, do you think?
That's how many people would perceive this, because the person who is speaking is the one of the most powerful leaders of the governing BJP, and he's also the Home Minister. All these years, they were celebrating the annual Hindi Day. Ministers will make comments, but no one would take them seriously, because the background to this, the whole episode, is that, you know, this is a Hindu majority country. This is what the government is trying to push. So one nation, you know, one language theory will not go very well where people are not speaking this language in other parts of India. And that is why people are worried. They say, we don't want one more Hindi imposition.
And Barrison Etarajan. Here in Britain, police are investigating the theft of a toilet from one of the best-known stately homes, Blenheim Palace. The loo in question is no bog standard facility. Sorry. It's worth over $6 million and made of 18-carat solid gold. It was designed as a piece of conceptual art by Italian artist Maurizio Cattelan. And as our reporter John McManus explains, it's a fully functional convenience that's been touring the museum circuit.
On display at the Guggenheim Museum in New York City first, where thousands of people queued to use it, and it was guarded by a security guard. It was then offered to Donald Trump at the White House. He turned it down, we believe, and it made its way to Blenheim Palace, as you say, one of our most famous stately homes. It was only there for a couple of days before it was stolen. Police say that thieves, probably several of them, because obviously it's very heavy to carry a solid gold toilet through the corridors of a stately home, carried it away sometime before 5 in the morning. And of course, the stately home itself, Blenheim, is very distressed about this. They say that they want to get it back. It's a unique work of art. Some journalists I've spoken to, though, who have seen the exhibition, who were there for the press review, were kind of a little bit more blasé about it. One of them, Hetty Judah, said, look, it's not like the Mona Lisa. The Mona Lisa, if it disappears, can never be repainted. But a solid gold toilet, especially if that's your kind of thing, if you like a bit of gold in the bathroom, that can easily be resculpted again.
You could actually use this toilet, couldn't you? And there was a 3-minute time limit, so the queue would be kept down. And I remember when they installed it, Blenheim Palace said, oh, we're not worried about security. We've got loads of security here. And then it's gone. It's been pinched.
They've certainly changed their tune this afternoon. They're very upset about the whole thing, though they do say that they were very relieved that none of their staff were hurt in the break-in. I hope you got that one.
I did. There was a snigger. John.
They would like it back. It's a serious issue, joking aside. A 66-year-old man has been arrested. Nobody's been charged yet, though.
That was John McManus. And let's hope the police can get to the bottom, did you get it, of that. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later, and I can promise you there will be fewer puns or jokes. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.